Venerable George is here. Okay, everybody, Venerable George will is standing by. He'll be with us in a moment. I'm Donna Cease. I'm Spiritual Programs Coordinator at Kadapa Center, and I'm standing in for Linda Saw tonight, who is moving into a new house today. I just want to take the moment to thank all our sponsors and donors who make Venerable George's visit possible, and to let you know that he will also be offering two weekend workshops while he's here. This coming Friday through Sunday will be on the eight verses of thought transformation, which allows us to transform our problems into happiness. And the following weekend, Friday through Sunday, November 20th through 22nd, he will be teaching on the Heart Sutra. And he will also do a second session of the DB Tantra next Monday. So that's the end of our announcements, and hopefully we'll see Venerable George very soon.
Hey.
Hello.
Good evening. Oh, come on. So, nice to be here with you guys again. Donna, I heard her say that while he's here, while I'm here in cyberspace, I'm actually in my cabin north of Asheville, so not so far from you, North Carolina. So, Donna, are there some preliminary prayers you wanted to do first, or can we just dive in and begin?
Oh, gosh, I was not organized on that.
You don't have to. I can lead some meditation, some motivational meditation at the beginning here. I was just wondering if you had some program that you'd forgotten in the excitement here.
I did. Well, we do normally have a few prayers that I'd forgotten in the excitement, and if you would like to lead a meditation, I can get that ready to share the screen in the meantime, behind the scenes.
Okay. So if you folks would like to join me in doing a little meditation, we'll try to calm our minds and... let's see here. I wanted to be able to see all the pictures of people. There's something to press here, isn't there? Oh, gallery view. Here we go. So sit comfortably for a moment and relax your body. Sit with your spine straight up and down. And eyes slightly open. Relax your mind, which is a much more... a difficult thing to do, reminding yourself there's nothing else you have to think about. And just place your attention, your mindfulness on the respiration, first of all, without controlling it, just watching it to such a firm way, such a strong way that no other thoughts are given any leeway. Put all of your attention, recognizing when you're breathing in, when it's changing direction, just when it begins to go out, it's going out, and follow it all the way till when it begins to change again. Like that. Start to pay attention, be mindful of your respiration. then if you've begun to calm the mind a little bit, leave your attention on the breathing and place it instead on the mental consciousness. Not your eyes, not your eye consciousness, not your ear consciousness, nose, tongue, or tactile. But what's going through your mind? Watch the thoughts without following them. Just note them passing, like sitting at a cafe, watching the passerbys without getting out of your seat and walking after them. There might be thoughts of the past, the future, plans, maybe observations of the present, thoughts that come up randomly, images, feelings. You may be lucky, there'll be a little period of time when there are no strong thoughts presenting themselves to the mind, and you have a feeling of spaciousness, openness of the mind. See if you can hold that and cause it to extend in time. If thoughts come up to interfere with that, let them go. Again, focus on that spaciousness, what we call the clear light nature of the mind, the conventional clear light nature of the mind. Don't get confused with your eye consciousness, which also, you know, might be perceiving light and space and so forth, but this clear light nature of the mind is something that is experienced by your mental wisdom. It's an object that transcends the ordinary objects of sight. And think, as you've studied in discovering Buddhism, that we have at this moment a life of very special significance, a life of leisure and endowment. That can be used for great meanings of achieving enlightenment, liberation, but even creating virtue and preparing the realizations of renunciation, love and compassion and bodhicitta, the right view of emptiness, and even leaving some imprints of tantric practice. So to think for the purpose of healing myself, getting closer to the state of being a real, authentic human being who's able to empathize with others and work for their benefit. For the aim of becoming even supremely enlightened for the sake of sentient beings, I'm going to participate in the class this evening, listening, contemplating, sometimes meditating on the material. Out of compassion for others, with a thought to become an individual, a person, a Buddha, who is able to spontaneously and effortlessly bring about the welfare of sentient beings to lead them out of cyclic existence into enlightenment. So with that motivation, you can relax again, bring your attention back to the present. Have a nice crowd here. Looks like 37 people. Maybe that's with Donna and myself. So, oh, Robert Watkins. Look at that. Robert Watkins is that. Okay. I just take a look at some of these other pictures. Is there another screen? Okay. Nice to see all of you. And so, Donna, is there anything else you wanted to add, or can we, should we start, or?
We can do some preliminary prayers.
You can put up, I think you, I can see, oh, look at that, okay.
All right. I'm sorry, I'm working with two screens here and having a little trouble with mine. Oh, there we go. Venerable George, would you prefer Tibetan or English?
Why don't we do in English?
Okay. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create
listening to the Dharma,
may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create to listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create to listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure. O holy and perfect pure Lama, from the clouds of compassion that form in the skies of your Dharmakaya
wisdom,
please release a rain of vast and profound Dharma, precisely in accordance with the needs of those to be trained. Idam Guru Ratnamandala Kam Nirya Chayami.
Thank you. So, nice to be here with you. So this is the unit on in Discovering Buddhism, I believe. That was called Discovering Buddhism. On Introduction to Tantra. And my brother Don Brown apparently gave the first lecture last Monday. This Monday and next Monday, I'll give a talk, and then the last class, Don will make up for any errors that I introduced. When I get a chance to correct that. So, from the point of view of Buddhism, especially from the point of view of Mahayana Buddhism, the teachings that Buddha gave that are, you know, most commonly known in the world are what are called, and one way of calling them are the teachings of the Sutra division of Buddhism. So we can say the Sutra teachings and the more esoteric teachings that he gave to more select group of individuals who were highly motivated are called the tantric teachings. In the sutra teachings, as you've learned, the Buddha gave teachings for the what are called the listeners, the hearers, the shravakas, and those that had a slightly higher intellect, called the pratika Buddhas or solitary realizers, where the aim was to achieve nirvana, liberation from cyclic existence. Still having compassion for sentient beings, but still under the influence of one's own interest, what we call self-cherishing thought. The Buddha did teach those individuals in the sutra section of higher intelligence what he calls the Mahayana teachings. So that term sometimes in Asia, in Theravada circles, is sometimes you're not supposed to use that word, or you're not supposed to use the word Hinayana, although in the Mahayana Sutras, in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, the Buddha himself said that those individuals who had intelligence and good heart shouldn't be satisfied with his Hinayana teachings. He said, my Hinayana teachings. So he himself taught the lesser vehicle, which is aiming for nirvana for oneself. He said they should forego that and develop the courage to achieve full enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. That particular state of mind that's aiming for enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings is called bodhicitta. And the individuals who have developed that mind are called bodhisattvas. Bodhi means enlightenment, right? Sattva means, sometimes can mean just sentient beings, sometimes it can mean courageous beings. So a courageous being who's aiming for bodhisattva. And the teachings that the Buddha gave on that are called the bodhisattva jnana. Jnana means vehicle. So he taught the Hinayana, comprised of the Shravaka and Pratika Buddha teachings. And he taught the Bodhisattva Jnana to lead to enlightenment. In those sutra teachings, it said that one needed to wait, what needed to accumulate merit, usually for around three countless great eons. That's a long, long time. Countless great eons. I won't go into detail. Maybe Don or others have mentioned what that amounts to. But the Buddha also taught that those individuals of highest intelligence, even among the Mahayana, among the bodhisattvas or aspiring bodhisattvas, who had incredible compassion for sentient beings, not willing to wait so long to come to their rescue as a Buddha, he taught a more sensitive and in some ways, dangerous, more difficult path called the Vajrayana, or as we call Tantra. There are various synonyms of that, right? Vajrayana, the Vajra vehicle. Tantra Jnana, the Tantra vehicle. It means the same thing, just different words. Also, he called it secret mantra, Guya mantra. So that's also a synonym of this path. And as Don Brown mentioned to you, at least he told me, that he made this distinction of what's called the causal vehicle and the resultant vehicle. Do you remember? Anyone shake their heads? Did he say that? He didn't. Okay. He didn't lead me astray. Okay. So the point is, in the sutra path, both the Hinayana and the Mahayana, the Bodhisattvayana, that is what's called the causal vehicle, because you're creating the causes to achieve enlightenment, which is something in the future. In Tantra, in the Vajrayana, in the secret mantra, is called the resultant vehicle, because you try to bring the situation of your future enlightenment into the present. You imagine what that's like, sometimes imagining, visualizing oneself as a deity, making offerings that are transcendent, and in so doing, you bring that future result as though it's in the present, and it creates a special method, a special kind of power to achieve that state of enlightenment more quickly. In the practice of Tantra, it's said that you can achieve enlightenment by elongating your lifespan through certain practices of, maybe Don mentioned there are four classes of Tantra that we generally mention. Did he mention that? No? There are four classes of Tantra. They have Sanskrit names, but in English it means, Kriya Tantra, which is action Tantra, Charya Tantra, which is performance Tantra, perhaps, Yoga Tantra, and then the highest, the pinnacle of those is what's called highest Yoga Tantra. And through the practice of any of those, it's possible to cause your lifespan to extend and to be able to accumulate merit for a long period of time, and even maybe even for eons, and achieve enlightenment that way. But through the highest level of Tantra, it's possible to achieve enlightenment in even one lifetime. And that doesn't mean by extending your lifetime, your lifespan for hundreds or thousands of years or eons and achieving after that time. But even in the course of three years, that is possible to achieve enlightenment through the practice of Tantra. So to leave an imprint in our mind now, an interest in Tantra, is incredibly fortunate. If we have the interest and the karma to be able to practice something of Tantra now, to leave an imprint in the mind, is incredibly fortunate, because it's said that in our world system that we live in now, we're part of a larger cosmos of world systems where Buddha Shakyamuni came and is in various... maybe in some of the worlds he's still teaching, some of the world systems, out in the galaxies out there, in some world systems where they're humans. In some he's already taught and passed away. In this world system he taught and passed away, but the teachings are still existing. In this, in our world system, where all these worlds that Shakyamuni has appeared are connected karmically, this is called the Saha world system. And there are said to be about a billion world systems. So, in a certain way, Buddhism will not be surprised if we find alien cultures, sending out messages or something like that. It'd be interesting. Maybe we should send out, rather than sending out these cryptic things that some of the scientists suggest, maybe we should be sending out mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, or some other things to get the interest of some of these other world systems, see if they'll respond. But these billion world systems, sometimes called 3,000 worlds, and you know what that means, right? Have you heard that expression? How could 3,000 be a billion? Well, it means 10 to the third. So Well, no, not 10 to the third. 1,000 to the third. 1,000 cubed world systems. So 1,000 world systems, 1,000 of those, that makes, what, 1,000,000? And then 1,000 of those, that makes 1,000,000,000 world systems. All of these world systems, the Buddha taught. So in this billion, these billion world systems, it's said that while they still exist, while they're still in the process of abiding and not disintegrating yet, 1,000 Buddhas will appear. And only 3 of those Buddhas will definitely teach Tantra. I said the first Buddha, where Shakyamuni Buddha was the fourth, right? The fourth Buddha of these 1,000. The first Buddha, the fourth Buddha, and the last Buddha will teach Tantra. So Tantra is, the teachings of Tantra are even more rare than the Mahayana. Mahayana teachings are, well, Buddhism in general, the teachings of Buddha in general are rare. Like the, you know, the example of the turtle on the bottom of the ocean. You know that example? Anyone? Okay, a couple of people nodding. Anyone say no? You don't know? Okay, the turtle example of the having a life of leisure and endowment. So the fundamental teachings is the frequency of that is like a turtle that sits on the bottom of the ocean for 100 years. And once every 100 years, it comes to the surface for 1 second, comes to the surface, sticks its head up, takes a gulp of air. Oh, there's Don Brown. His head just came out of the ocean there. And takes a gulp of air and then comes back down. That's supposed to be how frequently we come up to the upper realms, to the human or God realms. Once in a long, long time, a golden yolk that's coming on the surface, floating on the surface of the ocean, happens to coincide where our turtle comes up and puts his neck through. That's the frequency of having a life of leisure and endowment. Very, very infrequently. To come up when also not just the general Buddhist teachings are available, but when the Bodhisattva teachings are available, are even more rare. And even much more rare than that is to come in contact with the teachings of Tantra, have a chance to practice them. So it's said that in our own tradition, the Gelugpa tradition, that there might be a fourth Buddha who will teach Tantra, who is possibly going to be the reincarnation of Lama Tsongkhapa. Not sure when that will be. But anyway, to leave an imprint in our mind now, hearing about Tantra, aspiring for that, thinking, although Tantra is in a sense the pinnacle of Buddhist teachings, how to achieve enlightenment, sort of like the greatest thing, right? It's not necessarily suitable for anyone who wants to practice it. You need to have very special qualities to be eligible to practice, to have the chance of success in practicing. You need to have a vast amount of merit, and you need to have a greater intelligence than the usual bodhisattvas. Okay? So, by the way, if anyone has questions as I'm speaking, you're welcome to either send a message to Donna and she can ask a question, or you can raise your hand if you like to speak the question yourself, and I'll call you out if I can see you. So, in order to practice Tantra, you need to have a firm foundation of the basic teachings, what Lama Tsongkhapa called the 3 fundamental aspects of the path. Have you heard that expression before? 3 aspects of the path, yeah? So renunciation, which is the special flavor of the Hinayana. But we need to have even greater renunciation. Renunciation of means renunciation of cyclic existence. It's not the same as, like, say, a father who is annoyed with his son who's gone off and gotten drunk or something like that and say, I renounce you, or the son renounces the father, you know, giving up. Renunciation means a state of mind that has seen the defects of cyclic existence, samsara, and seen the benefits of nirvana, liberation from cyclic existence, and is striving for that goal. So you need to have an understanding of that to practice Tantra. You may not have to have actually achieved renunciation, but you need to have an understanding of it, an appreciation for it, and a desire, you know, to have the energy to do that. That's the first thing. You also need to have a greater motivation than just achieving liberation to practice Tantra. In fact, it's impossible to be able to practice Tantra successfully without having a further motivation of what we call bodhicitta. So bodhicitta means, as you've heard, the mind that's aspiring for enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings, foregoing one's own personal liberation. Those are sort of like firm foundation in terms of motivation. You need to have the, in fact, you need renunciation even to develop bodhicitta. You need to, in order to want to escape, in order to desire enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings, understanding how sentient beings are suffering in cyclic existence, even the people that look successful, or the people who are wielding power and who are cruel, I won't mention any names, you have to have a compassion for them by understanding renunciation, having an appreciation for the suffering nature of cyclic existence. And understanding that, you can empathize with all sentient beings, their plight, even if they're in high status, certainly if they're in low status, and wanting to achieve enlightenment to help them escape from that. The special flavor of the three principles, both of them depend on to achieve their goals, renunciation wants to achieve liberation, bodhicitta that wants to achieve enlightenment. Both of them depend on a certain kind of wisdom that we call the wisdom of emptiness. Emptiness called shunyata. Have you heard of shunyata? Yeah. Emptiness doesn't mean nothingness, as you've heard. Have you had a unit on emptiness? Yeah? Something? Yeah. Okay, some thumbs up. Emptiness is a very special kind of wisdom. It's on the wisdom side. So renunciation and bodhicitta, these two motivations, are what are called the method side. We talk about method, I should put it in my right hand, method and wisdom. The two methods here are renunciation and bodhicitta. And the wisdom side, especially, although there's many kinds of wisdom, a particular wisdom that penetrates and understands that the appearances that we have, our eyes, our ears, you know, if you can say appearance to the ear, you know, appearance to the nose, consciousness, the tongue, tactile, to your mind, all of these things that seem to be so real and concrete are actually devoid of a certain kind of reality that we attribute to them. we need to have sort of an understanding of that wisdom. These three fundamentals of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness, are those fundamentals that you need to have. Like I say, you don't have to have actually actualized those realizations yet, but you need to have an understanding of them intellectually, and you need to have a desire to develop them and some energy to try to do that. Maybe you've heard that in, as I mentioned before, the in highest yoga tantra, it's possible to achieve enlightenment in one short lifetime, like the great Tibetan saint, Milarepa. Milarepa, during a certain period of time when he was meditating, he was able to achieve enlightenment in that one lifetime, many hundreds of years ago. When he entered into that practice, he had not yet developed renunciation or bodhicitta or the right view of emptiness, but he did understand them and have a desire to practice them. And in the it said that in the course of 3 years in a meditative retreat, if you had that foundation through the practice of tantra accumulating an immense amount of merit, that you can achieve the realization of renunciation, the realization of bodhicitta, and have even a direct realization of emptiness, not just a general realization of emptiness, but like the real thing. What's that famous ice cream store in town? Is it Culver's? No, not Culver's. The one they have the concrete shake. Robbie and Don always take me there. I can't remember. Sort of like that's the
Goodberries.
Was it?
Goodberries.
Goodberries, right. Goodberries. So that's the real thing, right? So direct realization is like the Goodberries thick shake or whatever it is. Now, in addition to those fundamentals of the path, those three fundamentals, three principal aspects, in order to practice tantra, you have to have a special relationship with a spiritual guide. We say guru, right? Or Tibetans say lama. Do you know those words mean the same thing? The Tibetan word lama is the Tibetan translation of the Indian word guru. Isn't that something different? Guru in Sanskrit comes from a root grr that means heavy. So it kind of means like someone who's heavy in quality, substantial. Lama, the way the Tibetans put the etymology, they emphasized someone who's compassionate, like the mother, ma. And la, in the la of lama means higher. So it means, you know, almost like compassionate mother. But anyway, you need to have a relationship with a spiritual guide who teaches tantra, secret mantra. And you need to have received a introduction, a special introduction that's called empowerment, modeled on the way that kings and queens received their sovereignty. You know, even today, you know, there's a ceremony where the crown is put, I think it November 15th, what's it called? The Crown? Is that the name of this Netflix series? Or The Queen? Or what? Yeah, The Crown. That's going to come on again on November 15th. So there's a portion of the ceremony that's a crown. There's an ablution ceremony that's called the Vaz. You know, like when a king or queen is given their sovereignty. They're given the scepter, right? There's a Vajra initiation. And I'm not sure in the like the king or queen of England, but there's also a bell initiation, and you're named as the the king or queen. So there, in modeling, in a model of that, there is an introduction to the deity that you would like to practice that's called an empowerment. Or sometimes people say initiation. So you have to have a tantric initiation, which is just another way of translating what I'm calling an empowerment, a tantric empowerment. So what happens in a situation like that, if you have a familiarity with the fundamentals of the path, certainly you have to be a Buddhist. You have to have taken refuge sincerely from the depth of your heart. And you have to take the what we say, the promises or the vows of the Bodhisattva, the wishing vows, at least to take just a preliminary initiation, but you need to have the what's called the engaging vows of the Bodhisattva to actually take a full empowerment. Does that make sense to you? Let me pause for a second and see if anyone has any questions. What is he talking about? If anyone has a question, you can, if with Donna's permission, you can unmute yourself and speak up. No one? You all look happy? Let me see here. Still have 38 people. Okay, you haven't left yet. Okay. So sometimes I've been asked by college class in Buddhism to give a talk about Tantra, and the instructors always want to say, the necessary fundamental is that you have to have an empowerment. That's what they're taught. But even before that, the necessary prerequisite to practice Tantra is to have a firm foundation of renunciation, a real practice of bodhicitta, and to have taken the tantric bodhisattva vows. And you have to have some understanding of the wisdom of emptiness, have some little bit of experience of that. Then, on the basis of that, if you are present with the willingness of the guru who is giving a tantric empowerment, you can't just barge in or sneak in or something, or listen over the speaker in the kitchen or something like that. You have to be, in the presence of the guru. Maybe you can receive empowerment over the web. I think the Dalai Lama and others have given, but you have to, with the permission of the guru, you imagine in the presence of the Buddhas, you imagine your teacher, the tantric guru, which we'll speak about in a minute here, which you will develop during the course of the empowerment, a very special relationship with, a very heavy karmic connection with them, which, if practiced properly, can help you to accumulate, vast amounts of virtuous karma, merit, in a shorter period of time. If you don't practice correctly, if you get disgusted or develop wrong view, and you break the commitments that are given during the tantric initiation, you can create very heavy negative karma. So that's why sometimes Tantra is said to be, it's called the swift path, quick path to enlightenment, but it's also a dangerous path, kind of like Indiana Jones or something like that, going to get the treasure right with a the Nazis in the desert or whatever it was. So you need to receive an empowerment in the presence of the guru, where the guru asks you to visualize the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the tantric deity to which you are being introduced. You are being, when we talk about the empowerment, it's sometimes called entering the mandala of the deity. The mandala means kind of like the environs, the castle, the celestial mansion, and then the surroundings around that, entering into that to take the empowerment in the presence of the deity and the attending deities in that mandala. And you, through the force of your visualization, or at least even if you can't visualize the deities, imagining that you're following the instructions of the guru, one goes through various procedures of in their presence that introduce you to them, and maybe in a sense the guru is saying to them, my Buddhist son or daughter, John Kelly or Susie Bohm or Julie Lewis or Hemant and Patty Padia, I'm introducing, you to them. He says to the deities and says to you, I'm introducing you. And in so doing and following the procedure to the completion, one receives a kind of permission, a very special empowerment to be able to practice those tantric teachings. And although you can recite the mantras of the various deities, have you heard of, you've heard of mantras, right? You can recite mantras of deities generally without any kind of empowerment. You might even be able to visualize them in front of you, like Avalokiteshvara or Tara. We do it at the center, right? The Tara Knight, without necessarily having an initiation. Do you require, Donna, do you require any? Generally, no, right?
No.
So to recite the mantras and visualize in front, but to go into the further practices where you identify in the future you achieving the state of being Tara or Avalokiteshvara, where you arise as the deity, that requires having received an initiation, an empowerment into that deity. to try to do those practices without receiving an empowerment can lead to some bad circumstances. Sometimes some of the deities, the entourage of the deities, if you have not received an empowerment into those practices and you try to practice without that, they can actually harm you. So it's considered to be really a prerequisite to receive an empowerment into the deity, into the practice. So, as Don had said, there's a causal vehicle and the resultant vehicle. The resultant vehicle is the Vajrayana or the Tantra, where you might imagine through not just imagination, but understanding the possible evolution in becoming Avalokiteshvara or Manjushri or Tara or Vajrayogini or whatever. Imagine yourself as that, and using that imagination in visualization, visualizing yourself as maybe Manjushri holding a sword and in a text or Tara and so forth, using that as an object of concentration. So As I said before, in order to practice Tantra, you need to have an understanding of the fundamentals of the path, but you do not necessarily have to have achieved any of those states yet. Certainly, you don't necessarily have to have achieved perfect concentration. But in the practice of Tantra, by visualizing yourself as a deity or visualizing the deity in front, using that to concentrate on, instead of like concentrating on the breathing or concentrating on the clear light nature of your mind, concentrating on the appearance of yourself as a deity and developing a particular confidence, what we call divine pride of being the deity. Using those two factors, clear appearance of the deity and the divine pride of being the deity, using those as your focal object, developing single-pointed concentration. And also in that same visualization, meditating on emptiness, the appearance of yourself as Tara or Manjushri, whatever, appears to the mind as inherently existent, but analyzing it and in your visualization already built in a sense of rainbow-like quality, insubstantiality, understanding it, and understanding your self-identity and your possible identification with the deity as being non-inherently existent, using that to develop wisdom of emptiness. So sort of like an integrated package within which you can practice the fundamentals of the path, the three principal aspects, and because of the special connection with the spiritual teacher, the tantric guru, and this practice of Tantra, you can accumulate a vast amount of merit in a short time. Let me take, excuse me for a second, I have another sip of water here. So, you might think, well, this sounds really interesting. I'm going to look in the newspaper or the spiritual journals and see who's giving an initiation and go out and get one immediately. Because you say you have to have that. But in order to do it properly, you really have to have a connection with the teacher. It's said that for a spiritual teacher of the Mahayana, not even talking Tantrayana. If we talk about Hinayana Mahayana, Mahayana is comprised of the Sutrayana, the causal vehicle, and the Tantrayana. So they're both part of Mahayana. In the general Mahayana, even in the Sutrayana, to take on a karmic relationship with a spiritual guide, you really have to be careful. There's so many possibilities of making a mistake, you know, following someone who has a lot of charisma, speaks very sweetly, says things that sound attractive, but they may have ulterior motive. They may not really know what they may be exaggerating their own qualities. They may not really be qualified, and they can lead you astray. So in practicing Tantra, one of the fundamental teachings that's given beforehand is a deep understanding of how to relate to the spiritual guide, the guru, what we call guru devotion. So you may have received, is that part of the program of the Discovering Buddhism? Was there a unit on guru devotion? There was? Okay. Someone's getting a book from the shelf there. Is that a book on guru devotion? Okay. Someone is pulling down a book on guru devotion. So,
There are a couple of questions in chat whenever you're ready to take questions.
Let's take questions.
Okay. So one question is, are the empowerments like climbing a ladder, or is a particular empowerment prescribed for a particular devotee's circumstance?
So both. So sometimes with our own living tradition of our teachers in India and in Tibet, one might have received initiations, several initiations in the lowest tantras, the Kriya Tantra, say into Tara, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, Vajrapani, and so forth, maybe even others. And you might be practicing them in order to develop the particular actions that they're associated with, the particular qualities they're associated. For instance, Tara is said to be an embodiment of all of the Buddha's enlightened activities. Do you know what that means, enlightened activities, or let's say activities? Sometimes we say Mother Tara, right? So in order to help to develop that quality within yourself of being able to aid others, one might practice Tara. In order to develop and enhance your compassion and bodhicitta, you might take an empowerment into Avalokiteshvara. The Tibetans say Chenrezi, right? One and the same, just two different Indian language, Avalokiteshvara, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Chenrezi. You might take an empowerment into Chenrezi to develop compassion and bodhicitta. You might take an empowerment into Manjushri to enhance your wisdom of emptiness, or even other wisdoms, the wisdom of speaking and composing texts and the wisdom of debating and so forth. So you might take those at the beginning because they're the promises that you take in those empowerments of the lower levels of Tantra. Now, you were talking about someone was saying, are there a sequence? So we talk about four levels of Tantra that are more and more sensitive till you get to the highest one, highest yoga Tantra. The lowest one, still, you have to have the Bodhisattva vows. You have to take this initiation, this empowerment. But the vows that you take, the promises that you make during that empowerment are not as heavy as in the succeeding levels of Tantra. So you might be quite content and satisfied with practicing the lower levels of Tantra at the beginning, maybe that your whole life. Maybe even that you don't want to take. To take an empowerment in the highest yoga Tantra, within which you can achieve enlightenment in one short lifetime, you have to take more sensitive, you have to make more sensitive promises or take on vows. We call the tantric vows. So those vows, if you keep them, you can accumulate a tremendous amount of virtuous karma. That's one of the ways that you can create the karma. Also by your devotion and practice with respect to the guru and so forth. But if you break those vows, the karmic consequences are pretty heavy. Yeah, one of my teachers in Dharamsala many years ago, Geshe Nawandarge, used to say, breaking the tantric vows can result in your taking rebirth after death in the lower than the lowest hells. Usually the lowest hell realm is called the Avicii hell, right? Have you heard of that? The hell of unending, unrelenting suffering. You can be born in the Vajra hells. But Geshe Darge used to say, even then, you can have some pride. You can say, you know, to the other hell beings, there you say, I took the tantric vows, you know. Maybe in the future you'll, after all of that suffering has been experienced, you're born as a human again, you might encounter tantra because of that connection. But of course, it's best not to break the vows, of course. So that's a partial answer to that question, Donna. Is there another question?
Yes, and that you actually created a great segue to it, which is, if you took initiation but messed up and didn't practice, and maybe mess up even more, do you need to retake the initiation?
Yeah. So when I say yeah, I say good question. So if you have taken on a practice, even if it's of the lower tantras, and perhaps if you took the Avalokiteshvara practice empowerment, you made a promise to recite maybe three rosaries, three malas of Om Mani Padme Hum every day, or you know, certain number of mantras or something like that. And you got, you know, you got drunk one night, and then you got distracted in the Bahamas or something like that, and you gave up the practice for some time. What you should do is to, first of all, try to purify the negative karma of having abandoned your promises. So in Tantra, there are two kinds of promises you take. You certain things you promise to do and certain things you promise not to do. So like, say, to recite the mantras or to do a certain practice, what we call a sadhana, might be amongst the first kind. Generally, we call those kinds of things samayas or pledges that you promise to do. Although there are some samayas or pledges that are things you promise not to do. Generally, it's like that. And then there are other things that you promise not to do. You know, just like when we take vows, we vow not to kill or steal or engage in sexual misconduct or get intoxicated and so forth. So there's certain things that you promise not to do. Those are called the tantric vows. So in the lower tantras, there's not so many vows. There might be some samayas. You know, you promise to do the mantras. So you should try to do heartfelt purification practices, such as applying the four opponent forces. Have you heard of the four opponent forces? Is anyone who has not heard of the four opponent forces? I've heard about it. I was raising my hand if you haven't heard. Let me see. Look at the other people. Anyone who hasn't heard? Okay, you know what the four opponent. So to apply the four opponent forces, to do confession before the 35 Buddhas, where there's a liturgy where you confess the negative actions, you regret them, and so forth, and you recite the names of these 35 Buddhas who made promises in the past that even reciting their names would help sentient beings to purify particular karmas. You can do Vajrasattva meditation, Vajrasattva on your head, reciting, visualizing that and reciting the Vajrasattva mantra, imagining nectar coming and lights coming down, purifying you of negative karma. But the main thing are the four opponent forces. So having done that, even though another empowerment might not be readily available, you know, the next time your teacher gives that empowerment, even if you have to fly to Cincinnati or something, you would go to try to revive the vows. So you, two things: you purify the negativity of having maybe broken the samayas or vows, and then you try to revive the empowerment by taking it again. Alternative to that is if you've actually done a retreat, full retreat of a deity, I say Avalokiteshvara, you finish, and there's a fire puja at the end. Have you heard of that fire puja? Certain way to finish the retreat. And it's possible then, having done the retreat, certain number of mantras, even if you didn't do it perfectly, you did the fire puja at the end, it's possible to take that empowerment again yourself in your room all by your lonesome. That's what's called, sometimes people call it self-initiation, or more literally it's self-entry. That means entering into the mandala of the deity by your lonesome, by yourself. And in so doing, you can completely revive the tantric vows that you took. So I assume that the person who asked that question may not have done a retreat and fire puja yet, but they're just interested in that general thing. So if you have lapsed in your practices, it's good to try to do some purification practices, like I said, especially regretting having broken those promises. And if you can, to start the practices again, even if you haven't renewed the initiation, even if you haven't taken the empowerment again yet, to start doing that practice again. And then when an opportunity arises to take the empowerment, to take it again. Does that help? Donna?
Yes, very, yeah, she responded yes, very interesting. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. And then there was one further question.
Yeah.
In advance of the empowerment, are you choosing a specific empowerment based on your choice of deity or the guru? For example, Are you choosing a specific empowerment based on your choice of deity, or the guru is choosing the deity you'll have a karma connection with?
It can be both. Say, for instance, if you have a close relationship with a qualified guru, such as Lama Sopa Rinpoche or the Dalai Lama, they may encourage you to take a particular empowerment, like I said, especially in the lower tantras at the beginning. And later, I'll give an example. At the monasteries, at Sera Monastery, where Geshe-la, your teacher Geshe-la, studied, where I lived for a while. Lama Zopa's from there. Lama Yeshe was from Sarah J. Usually the monks might have had a couple of initiations of the lowest tantra when the Dalai Lama or the abbot of the monastery gave it, where there was not a lot of commitment, not a lot of promises that you made that you had to practice. But they were generally advised at the most to take one highest yoga tantra empowerment if they wanted to, but not to have more than that, because sometimes the commitments of taking an initiation empowerment in the highest, you know, the highest category, there, you would make a promise to perhaps recite the practice of that deity, the sadhana of that deity every day. Sometimes the long sadhana, which might take you an hour or an hour and 20 minutes every day, as long as you live. No vacations. Or you could, there are ways to abbreviate it, or you might have a shorter commitment. You know, maybe just to recite the mantras of that deity, depending on the instruction of the teacher, the guru. So the most important thing is to have a karmic connection with the guru, and to have investigated them, even if it's for a long time. In the general teachings of Buddhism, just in the sutra vehicle, the Mahayana, it said, not to choose any guru just on a whim, but even if you have to investigate the guru for 14 years, I don't know where that number comes from, maybe there's some special significance, even a long time, until you reach, you know, real, certainty that this person is not going to betray you, you know, someone who's qualified and so forth. So if you have that kind of It doesn't mean you have to wait 14 years to choose a guru, but it's good not to immediately, just to, as I said before, to choose someone because they're beautiful or handsome or because they speak well or they have a big reputation. You have to check. Have to check carefully, the same way that you check the teachings, like you're checking gold in the old days. Not to be fooled, you'd rub it and you'd cut it and you'd put it in a flame to see if there's some impurities there. So, remind me of the question again, Donna.
Sure. In advance of the empowerment, are you choosing a specific empowerment based on your choice of deity, or is the guru choosing the deity you'll have a karmic connection with?
So at the beginning, generally it's going to be, if you have a connection with the guru, that they will choose the deity that they're giving, maybe for the whole center, or maybe to you or a small group of people. Eventually, when you have practiced for a long period of time, you may have some karmic predisposition to practice a particular deity. You might be really, oh, I really want to practice the Amantaka, who's the wrathful aspect of Manjushri. That's me, I want that. There could be a desire, an interest because of previous life practice or a previous life interest again. You might choose, Galwa Gyatso, which is a highest yoga tantra aspect of Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig, because you want to practice, you still have that ambition to develop compassion for sentient beings, but you want to practice it in this highest mode. And then you would seek the guidance of your guru. If the guru has not, in order for a guru to give an empowerment, they themselves have to have done the retreat of that day. They have to have received the empowerment themselves. They have to have done the retreat and the concluding fire puja in order to give the empowerment to you. So your own guru may not have the empowerment that you want, but if you are sincere and you ask them, they may suggest another teacher who they know is qualified and suggest that you ask that teacher for that empowerment. Or they might say that teacher is giving the empowerment in New York or Ontario or India or someplace, and it would be good if you want that badly, this would be a test, get the air ticket. So it can be either way. In the beginning, it's generally wise to take the advice of one's own guru at the center. If someone like Lama Zopa comes, or His Holiness, or some other visiting teacher comes who at the behest of Geshe-la or the center, and they're offering an empowerment, to ask your own personal teacher, would it be okay for you to take that? And if they give permission, then that's good. And in some circumstances, when you've practiced for some time and you have the real desire to practice something, maybe, Vajrapani or something, you would ask your teacher, if they have that empowerment, would they give it to you? If they don't, maybe they can suggest a teacher who can give you that. That's my nutshell of that answer, attempt to answer to that question. Is that okay?
Yes. Okay. And just one question, which is a little bit off to the side, but essential too, is what is emptiness? So.
So you didn't raise your hand when I said, do you know what emptiness is? You were embarrassed. Okay. So, the understanding of emptiness is something that's pretty exclusive to Buddhism. You don't find this wisdom of emptiness in Christianity, Judaism, Islam. You don't find the wisdom of emptiness in Hinduism. Well, I'm using that word loosely. Generally, we say the Vedic religions, because there's a whole spectrum of them. You don't find it in other places. It was an insight that the Buddha had in starting from the experience of your own ego identity. All of our personal faults, whether they be anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, ignorance, low self-esteem, hysteria, whatever, they all have arisen because of the belief in a self-identity, a self of ourself. You know, who can I use? I have to put my glasses on. I'm getting old here. Dinesh might have a feeling, you know, I'm Dinesh. If I ask, who are you? You might say, I am a computer programmer. I'm a medical technician. I am an accountant. I'm a mailman or something. Then I keep on asking you who you are. You would say, well, I'm my body, my mind, I'm this or that. If you really search who you are, it's very, very elusive what the sense of self is. It seems in the long, if you search very deeply with deep wisdom, if you analyze your concept of the self, there seems to be something, you know, separate from what your vocation is, your profession, separate from your body and mind, a sense of self within your mind. Let's say that your mind conceives of that sometimes seems to be associated with the body. If someone says, "Oh, you're a little bit overweight there," you know. You think I'm the body, or someone said, "Oh, you're looking really good." You know, pride goes up, or someone says, "You are dumb." You kind of associate with your mind, but after a long search, you find that there's a sense of self that seems to be separate from the body and mind, existing there like the soul. I can't remember what Christian saints said, I mean, maybe it was Saint Ignatius or someone said, there was no need for a lot of proof of the soul. It was self-evident. I can, maybe one of us who studied Christianity would know what I'm talking about. From a Buddhist perspective, what they were referring to was this appearance to the mind of an inherently existent self, which Christianity calls a soul, at least in modern English. The Indians, it like in Hinduism, they call it the Atma, you know. So Buddha's insight was that although this appears so clearly to the mind and is the source of all of our other faulty states of mind, because of the sense of a self, there's a cherishing of one's own body and mind, the desire for happiness, the desire to be free of suffering for this self, giving rise to attachment and anger and everything else. So the Buddha saw that although this appears very clearly to the mind, it doesn't exist at all the way that it appears. It appears like a reflection appears. You can't say the reflection doesn't appear, right? But the reflection of yourself in a mirror is actually devoid of being you. Would you agree? You know what I'm talking about? Someone says yes, someone says no. So example I've given probably at the center a couple of times in the past, a student of mine in India was traveling, quite dirty. She wanted to go to a nice hotel, but at first she had to go to a cheap hotel to get washed, to put on her good clothes to go to the good hotel, right? So she goes to the Hilton after having gone to the cheap hotel where she took a shower, put on her nice clothes. As she's going in the front door of the Hilton or wherever, Sheridan, she sees another lady out of the corner of her eye wearing the same dress as her. And she's going, wow, that's amazing. She looks just like her. And then it turns out she realized it was her reflection in the one of those big glass doors. You know what I'm talking about in India? So sometimes we can mistake reflection for being real. We can mistake an echo, or let's say an echo of a dog, to be an actual dog over there. Actually, you hear one dog barking, you see him barking, and then you hear the echo of that dog. You say, oh, there's another dog barking over there. It's actually, there was a sound coming, but what you think is that there is a dog that's originating it over there. Actually, this dog started. It's actually devoid of the reality that you were attributing to it, as if that was being caused by a dog over there. So when you see, when you investigate the eye that appears to the mind, just like a reflection, just like an echo, like a dream. In a dream, if you're having a bad dream, which you may have had a lot recently before the election. I don't know. If you were like me, I had worrisome dreams. Anyway, you wake up from that, you go, oh, it's just a dream. Just a dream means you realize it appeared so real, but it was empty or devoid of the reality that you had attributed to it, right? So in that sense, the Buddha's special insight into the self was that the self was empty of existing the way that it appeared to the mind. It was just like a phantom, like seeing Brad Pitt on your TV. What did he play in that Paris or something in the Trojan Wars or something? You know, you might have said, oh, he's getting stabbed. You're crying, you know, Brad. He wasn't killed. It's just an illusion. You know, there are various examples that the Buddha gave of things that appear to our mind that appear to be real, but are actually devoid of the reality that we attribute to it. As a way of not approving emptiness, but a way of beginning to understand how things like the self can appear to be so real, but to not exist the way that they appear. So that in the Hinayana teachings, generally the Buddha didn't use the word emptiness. He used the word selflessness. So we talk about the selflessness of the person. In the Mahayana, the Buddha extended that to not only our self identity, but all phenomena. My computer, my MacBook Pro, my iPad, my Tonka, my Subaru, whatever, you know, all of those things that seem to exist out there are in the same way devoid of a certain kind of existence that we attribute to them. They appear like the illusion, like Brad Pitt, like the echo, like the reflection, like the dream, but they're devoid of the reality. Once you've realized emptiness of them, it's like waking from the dream and that, oh, there's no problem. You know, it's the great source of fearlessness. So it's getting on to 8:30, which I think is the time we're meant to finish, right?
Yeah.
So why don't we just do a little short meditation and dedication tonight? And then next week, we'll talk a little bit more about Tantra. And if you have some questions from tonight, either you can, with Donna's permission, either you can send them to her or you can store them up for next time. So sit comfortably again. Maybe you're tired. Relax your body. Relax your mind. See if you can comment by first watching a few inhalations and exhalations. Being mindful of your breathing. And then go deeper to the, let go of your attention to the breathing, to the mental consciousness. All these factoids that you have there, let go. Just try to see the spaciousness of the mind. And reflect upon the fact that in listening to the talk this evening, paying attention, analyzing, contemplating, maybe meditating a little, you've created virtuous karma because of the special motivation at the beginning that we were listening to the teaching in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings, all sentient beings. This merit will definitely ripen unless it is destroyed by anger or something else. But it will, without dedication, it will ripen within cyclic existence and be gone. Like planting a seed of a bush that just comes once and you cut down the bush and enjoy it at dinner and or dessert. So to elongate the efficacy of this karma that we've created to protect it, think that whatever merit I've created this evening and in my life, even in the past and in the future, I dedicate to my continual spiritual development from life to life, up to and including my achievement of enlightenment. May this karma not cease bringing results until I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Due to these merits, may I quickly become a Buddha for the sake of all living beings. Thank you very much. So that was fun for me anyway. May have been boring for you. But and I'm sure Brother Don will send me a blistering email if I've made some mistakes. Or Robbie will say, you shouldn't have talked about that, or you should have talked about this. So I look forward to seeing you next Monday. And if you have time this weekend for Kadampa Center, again, there'll be, I'll give some talks Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on the 8 verses of training the mind, which is the way to transform adverse conditions into, you know, how to be happy when you're not, and how to develop bodhicitta. And then the weekend after that, there'll be a seminar on the Heart Sutra, which the last time I was actually resident at Kadampa Center for a while, we were going to do, and Donna called us up, we were driving to the center to give the Heart Sutra talk, and she said, oh, the gas is escaping in the Gompa, so we never got a chance to do that. So we can finish that. That'll be a seminar, more detailed than we would have been able to do before. So hope to see you then, and thank you for coming and for your good questions.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Thanks, Donna. Thanks, Don. Thanks, Robbie. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Oh, good night.
Thank you.
Thank you, and good night.
Thanks, Venerable George.
Thanks, Donna.
Sure.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Donna.
Thanks.